You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, Burnaby, BC.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we unpack why the economy is so uneven, unseriously wrong, introduce the Catholic roots of Quebec's social democratic tradition on the Broadband Institute's perspectives, explain why public healthcare advocates are protesting in response to Alberta's new two-tier healthcare law on red eye, and celebrate the triumphant return of Unmaking Saskatchewan. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. Also, if you're in Montreal, don't miss Harbinger Soapbox Volume 7, a live podcast recording and book release titled Sports Washing and Imperialism at Bar Milton Park Co-op on Thursday, April 16th from 6 to 9 p.m. with The End of Sport, Habibti Please, CUTV, Maisonneuve Magazine, Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, and Palestinian Youth Movement. It'll be a great night, so hopefully see you there. And broadcasting since 2022, Unmaking Saskatchewan is an anti-capitalist, anti-colonial podcast focusing on how the province of Saskatchewan was made and how it can be unmade, with Regina-based hosts Sarah Burrell and Briar Patch publisher John Cameron. On this highlight from a new episode, Sarah and John return after almost a year hiatus to discuss the federal NDP's election of Avi Lewis as leader and explore how the Saskatchewan NDP have responded by fixing their aim on irrelevancy and slamming down the throttle. Now, here's the show.
Hello and welcome back to Unmaking Saskatchewan. I'm Sarah Burrell.
I can hear the rustle of the wheat fields blowing softly on the plain.
I'm John Cameron. We just talked about how to start this before the podcast, and Sarah said she was going to introduce, and then I immediately said hello first.
Where a man has room to see the setting sun. Saskatchewan.
That's right. You did. And then I said, I'm going to say, we went over this. I said, I'm going to say I'm Sarah Burrell, and then you can say I'm John Cameron. And then, John, there was a long lag there where I feel like you weren't ready. You weren't ready to, like, come in and just say I'm John Cameron. And I don't want to put, like, a lot on you for that, but you didn't.
Yeah, it was because I immediately regretted the hello thing, and I just immediately sent the whole project off the rails.
Mm-hmm. Importantly, we could have edited that out, but we will not now. This is all going in there. So everybody who's been waiting for a year for a follow-up episode, this is it. Here, welcome. We're really glad to have you. And we hope it's been a great year. How has your year, the Carney year, been for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's been, how do I put this? I feel like it's been really just a demoralizing year watching the Carney Imperium, the 100-year Carney dynasty, sort of take shape. Like, the way that so many people have kind of fallen so easily in line with, like, the kind of predictable austerity agenda that the guy's been bringing to the table. It's yet to happen. I think the shine might come off now that we're spending $60 billion to meet a NATO target for a completely failing NATO, like, in terms of military spending, like, the day before Donald Trump blows it up based on the date of our current recording. And that's, you know, to get there, we've had to institute Volcker shocks across kind of the entire Canadian economy. So it's going to be cool watching that happen in the middle of a global energy crisis. That might take the shine off it a little bit, or who knows, that might be a bunch of sandbags around it. And I think it's also happened even in Saskatchewan, where there's like a weird, you know, there has been a little bit of a pivot to like Carney out in the prairies out in the west, but there's also been just as much of a like kind of revelation of like, oh, people kind of hated the aesthetics of Trudeau's Liberal Party more than they hated the principles or the practice, which like now that Carney is putting those principles in ruthlessly to practice, a lot of people are like, well, like him or hate him, he is the prime minister, you know.
We actually really like it. Yeah, the shine has not gone off him as much as you maybe would have thought. He's like pretty popular. 68% approval is like territory that we just like that. It's just like I don't know that many of us are like familiar with just operating in the kind of environment where the prime minister has a 68% approval rating. Like it's just wild. And so yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a brutal summer though.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this to you privately and I've tweeted it, but like just the vibe going when people are able to be like outside and in person on a consistent basis, and the weather gets like hot enough to be out for more than like a couple of hours at a time, there is something in the air. I think people are gonna just go nuts this year. I think it's gonna I think it's just going to be a very strange year altogether. And I think combined with like whatever Carney is going to be doing to the like getting in and ripping all the copper pipe out of the Canadian economy in order to fund a military, it probably what we got to say is one of the more popular times to be thinking about the military and fighting a war. Yeah, when we see that pop off, I think it's gonna get real weird.
I will say, and I think maybe this is the last thing we'll say about the Carney year before we get to what we actually want to talk about today, but this I think I'll definitely be circling back to this. I think it's kind of relevant, is that it's been a great year for Scott Moe. The Carney year has been a great year for Scott Moe. I think that probably like no single premier, at least, and maybe no a single person has reaped as many benefits, you know, directly just in terms of like a boost to his popularity, the endurance of his party. Like he really revived kind of something that was maybe starting to flag a little bit. It should have been flagging a lot more, but the opposition here is so weak. But, you know, like Scott Moe, right from the start, you know, I think one of the earliest meetings with Carney, he had Moe on his right and Danielle Smith at his left, right? And Moe took that and ran with it, right? Like whatever Carney offered him or whatever Carney said to him, he said, okay, I'm going to play ball with this guy. And he did, and he's seen benefits. Yeah. You know, Moe has, and Saskatchewan have seen benefits with that. Carney has traveled with them. They are very tight. And Moe is incredibly popular, you know, and somebody who should be and was coming to kind of the end of his popularity, maybe coming to the end of what his career could have been, you know, just like the natural conclusion of somebody who's been in that position for as long as he has. And he's had like a real revival, you know, from that. And I think that probably helps with, you know, retaining some of Carney's popularity out here. Is that like Moe is his guy.
Yeah, big time.
Which is not something I anticipated at all. I did not see that
Do
coming.
You remember, you know? Like shortly after the election, there was a lot of stuff on Twitter that was like trying to prove, like people were doing like the body language analysis, and people were like drawing the two lines to be like, oh, he likes him, oh, he hates him, right? But it's like, right. Like Moe has benefited hugely from it, both in terms of like optics and popularity and whatever, like internally, but also just like both in Saskatchewan and federally. He's getting what he fucking wants, right? Like that's the real thing. That's the real reason that they work so well together. It's also like you can kind of see it in Ontario, like Ford and Carney are also getting along great. And that's because Ford is getting everything he wants
because they're all conservatives.
Because we're being run by a central banker and he is governing like a central banker. And that means that all of our like biggest right wing freaks and psychos are getting the country that they want. And like I said, it'll be fun this summer. For some of us, I guess, and probably not fun for a lot of us to find out what happens when all that, well, that starts hitting the fan.
All right. Well, let's get to the NDP convention this past weekend. And what, how are our fine, Saskatchewan NDP and their Tweedledum to the west, the Alberta NDP, how they responded to the election of Avi Lewis to be the leader of the NDP.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big one thing. It was like a pretty firm win for Lewis, right?
It was a rout. Like, that was a first ballot win where if every single person who came in after McPherson had given, like, if all of those votes went to McPherson, she still would have lost.
Yeah, it was a majority, you not know, a plurality,
like,
right?
Absolute victory. Like, he completely won, and won the executive too, right? Like, the slate that supported Lewis won the executive, which I think is probably, like, much better. Like, that's, like, more significant even than Lewis winning, because, like, that kind of structure, that internal structure, is really what holds up the NDP and causes a lot of problems for the NDP. So, like, that was big and like, a big moment for, like, left values in the NDP.
It was also a good little lesson. It clearly, like, somebody at the NDP or some people at the NDP learned some lessons from Jeremy Corbyn and thought, like, oh, it's probably actually helpful to have people inside the internal structure of the party who aren't going to be dedicated to the next 5 years to just, like, repeatedly stabbing the guy we've elected as leader in the back. It would be nice if we elected, you know, a group of people who will theoretically get along. So, but that also means again that, like, oh, mood in the room for the federal party is kind of overwhelmingly in, like, one direction, right? Which is, like, tilted towards a rebuild, not just like in terms of trying to get the raw numbers up, but in terms of, like, trying to recommit to a set of principles, a set of values, and to work the party in reasonably, like, unified step towards it, which is when we talked last year about, like, the kind of decimation of the federal NDP, like, that was one of the few prospects that we saw as, like, a way forward for that party. And it seems like a lot of people maybe share that broad sentiment, or share, like, an understanding of the idea that, like, the party can't just proceed the way it always has and assume that its time is coming soon, which brings us maybe a little bit to where there's a discord between, which we also sort of talked about on the last episode a year ago, the growing discord between, like, the provincial NDPs, which see themselves as one thing, and the federal NDP, which to survive is going to have to see itself as another.
And yeah, the response, I mean, from Carla Beck in Saskatchewan and from Naheed Nenshi in Alberta to the election of Lewis, which again was, like, decisive, like the people that voted, both the people who were, like, physically there in Winnipeg for convention and voted for the executive, and the people who voted, you know, over this past, God, what, 40 years? Has it been 40 years since they started, like, looking for a new leader? You know, all of those people who voted decisively for Lewis and this, whatever, this left vision, this, like, post-Petro state vision. And the Saskatchewan NDP and Alberta NDP, like, still came out in response to that and were very reactive against it. I think, like, and Carla Beck's position here is unbelievably tenuous. Like, to come, she put out a letter.
Yeah.
And in the letter, you know, just basically says, like, you know, we're not going to meet with Lewis. We don't want to meet with Avi Lewis because he doesn't like oil and gas. And that is offensive. It's offensive to our culture. And so and it was, like, an incredibly childish little letter, like, a very bad position, I think, to put yourself into as somebody who is, like, the leader of a party who is, like, you're in the wilderness, Carla.
Yeah.
You are in the wilderness. And this past year has pushed you out further into the wilderness than you probably ever have been before. Yeah. Like, you know, like, every advantage and success that Mo and the Saz Party have gained from Mark Carney has also been a blow to Carla Beck and the NDP. Like, they are more irrelevant than they have ever been. Like, you need a f***ing ally. And the ally that Carla Beck thinks that she needs is Naheed Nenshi and the Alberta NDP, the losingest NDP in the history of NDPs.
This is a highlight from a new episode of Unmaking Saskatchewan. Find it at harbingermedianetwork.com. or wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2014, Vancouver-based Seriously Wrong is a bi-weekly utopian leftist comedy podcast featuring co-hosts Aaron and Sean and occasional guests in conversations exploring rent strikes, the justice system, airplane food, and more. Like on this excerpt from a recent episode, exploring why the economy is so uneven with guest Cathal Moran, an economist and the host of the YouTube channel Unlearning Economics. Now, here's the show.
Warning. Classic economic models incorporate zero variables to account for the essential role that the convivial glue of neighborly love plays in economic and social life.
Are you serious?
Welcome to the Line Go Up investment podcast.
Line, which way is it going? Up.
Up.
Real tips and tricks that you can use in your life for financial success, literacy, and winning.
This is the only podcast that will give you 100% accurate investment advice so you're able to do things like buy a bigger house, car, maybe you could get a leisure property or a fast vehicle. And what we always say here is the more money you have, the richer you are. And that's what makes our podcast different. I think we want to start by picking up on our previous conversation, our deep and multifaceted critique of the economic literalism that has taken over our political world, who it benefits and so on. And we think before you start investing, you need to get a little bit of a background.
You really want to think about the field of economics itself critically, learn about its history, learn about its basis, learn about what's really going on.
Yeah, and that involves often busting myths. Mm-hmm. It's a house of cards. The political economic order is a house of cards. The discipline itself of economics, theoretically, if fully developed across an entire spectrum understanding of economics, is certainly its potential. It's important, but we've inherited a shriveled, I'm trying to think of the metaphor, is it culturally appropriate to say like a voodoo head? You know, a shrunken head. You remember that from like Halloween specials or whatever growing up? I don't know.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Where does that come from? What is that? Is that, I feel like there's a colonial gaze in that. We won't use that on the Line Go Up investment podcast, just in case there's probably some weird history there.
Sometimes it's best. Just leave it there.
So before the investment advice, which we give at the end of the show, we have an interview that you did earlier, and we have it on tape.
Yeah, are we breaking character now?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like we are, yeah.
I'm just so confused.
We're kidding. We're not actually that. I had an idea, though, with the tape thing.
Uh-huh.
What would it sound like if I said, I've got a tape player in my butt, right? I've got a tape player in my butt. And you got a tape with the interview. Just thinking in sound design terms, I can only imagine. The audience will know. I'll be like, oh, I got a tape player in my butt. So you got a tape.
In my butt?
No, just in your hand, I think.
Oh, okay.
Unless you want to extend the bit.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought you were saying you had a tape player in your butt and there was a tape in my butt and we have to like kiss butts.
What if you hit eject on your tape player in your butt? And then my butt was ready to receive the tape, and the tape was a color brown.
What if?
But anyways, my point is I've got a tape player in my butt. You've got a tape, which is not brown. It's blue. It's like a pleasant blue. And it's the interview that you did.
Yeah, the interview.
So I'll just pull down my pants here.
Moran.
One of the ways we can play tapes at the show. And I'm really curious what this sounds like in sound design. So here's my butt, which the tape can go in. Tape popping sound. Okay, yeah, and then to make the tape play, you have to press my nipple.
And this is not, I guess, self-conscious about all the butts, being like, oh, this is a butt interview.
This interview has nothing to do with butts. No, I'm so sorry.
No, it's...
I feel bad now that you bring that up.
Now I brought this whole thing, this whole butt thing.
No, this interview is just a fart.
Hanging away. It's not that the interview's a fart. It's that the fart is being harnessed by a machine the way that you might like squeeze the lip of a balloon to make it squeal, but in a very precise way that produces the tones.
It's a new kind of tape player.
In people's butts, yes.
Yeah.
And it's not something we were going to do every week either. So that's part of why I feel bad.
Because it's such a great interview. And
it is, yeah.
You're such a great guest.
And we didn't even think to bring up butts when you're talking about heterodox and critical economics based in like class analysis, which is what his great book did. It has nothing to do with tape players and butts. And
everything to do with economics and the world that we live in.
You know what? Forget the butt thing. Here, let me push the eject button, my other nipple. Here, take this tape back. Put it on a regular tape player. This is totally disrespectful to the guest.
We do have a normal tape player here as well. Obviously, we use it all the time. Yeah. So we'll just pop it in there.
Forget about the tape butt thing, guys.
Yeah, it didn't even happen as far as you're concerned.
It's basically a dream sequence. It's not canon that way.
Totally.
Yeah. But we did experience it. We're not hiding.
Dreams are real in a sense.
Absolutely. Nary been said often enough, unfortunately, in this capitalist society.
Hit play. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Seriously Wrong podcast. I'm excited this week to be talking to Cahal Moran, author of a new book, Why We're Getting Poorer, but who I know initially from the YouTube channel, Unlearning Economics, which is a great resource. And welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for inviting me on. I really love this podcast. I think it's one of the few good podcasts.
I don't want to cast aspersions on other podcasts, but I also agree. I like to think we're an effort posting podcast. We try to put a lot of...
Yeah, that's actually how I think about it. You do skits and you do research and you put effort into putting it together. It's not just a couple of idiots making stuff up and spreading misinformation. The bar is low, but...
The bar might be low, but we still cleared it, so... let's start with talking about the book a little bit. At the danger of oversimplifying, it feels like a lot of what you're saying here is that the problem with the economy, the reason why we're getting poorer, is the power of the ultra wealthy and the amount of control they have over the economy and therefore the political process. And that just ricochets throughout the entire world because economics, it reaches into every part of life. And this uneven economy is the title of your first chapter. The inequality that we have is a result of power being accumulated to this small group.
So my dad read the book and he said to me, it's not really about everyone getting poorer, is it? It's about a lot of people getting poorer while a very few people get much richer. So I think that's absolutely right. I think that if you were to highlight one factor that is driving a lot of these things, it is inequality. And I think, to be honest, so I finished writing the book like a year ago, pre-Trump 2.0, and this has only gotten more true, sadly, since I finished writing the book. I actually feel like I kind of understated the problem, weirdly, because there's this chapter on billionaires where I'm talking about how much control billionaires have, how they take control of their own industry, they price out competitors, and then they take control of industries that are related to it and take control of the supply chain. But then they start buying up other industries or starting other businesses or philanthropic projects that don't necessarily have anything to do with their immediate industry. And then they start buying up media and social media and then influence. And then they also start to buy influence in government. And I just think that's accelerated so much since I finished writing the book, especially in the USA. You've just seen this process unfold. And I do think that it is the source of a lot of problems. You know, we have industries that are monopolistic and they're not really fit for purpose. Media organizations that are towing a specific line because they're owned by a select few people with a specific agenda. And we have extremely corrupt or at best kind of stilted government that won't go against the interests of the ultra wealthy. And not only those things, which are bad in themselves, but you've got this backlash, haven't you? You've got people understand that this is happening on some level. people understand that the elites are out of touch, they're corrupt, that things aren't working for the average person, that there's a lot of inequality, social cohesion and trust have gone down. And I think that basically this is one of the main causes of the political situation that we have now. So yeah, I do think if I had to highlight one aspect of the global economy, and it's not just billionaires, right? It's just inequality in itself. We still have an immense amount of poverty in the world that is simply solvable. There are so many trials. Maybe we didn't need rigorous randomized control trials to show this, but we have them now that show that, you know, if you give poor people money, oh my God, they stop being poor. It's incredible because now they have the money to afford things, right? And that has a whole bunch of positive knock-on effects. It doesn't have any of the negative effects that people worry about. You know, they stay at home or smoke loads of cigarettes or whatever. So by reducing inequality, by reining in the rich and powerful and redistributing from them to the poor, we could solve so many of our problems. And I regard it as a great failure, a great moral failure, to be honest, let alone economic, but a great moral failure that we just continue not to do so.
Yeah, what's happening in the States right now is crazy with Elon Musk and Trump and like Peter Thiel and J.D. Vance. They've been so cushy and close, and the U.S. has been terrible for allowing major mergers of giant companies to happen for like decades now. But under Trump, it's gotten even worse. They're letting like even these few remaining media companies, many of them are trying to merge now. And yeah, the political power of the wealthy has never been like so in your face.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I go into it in chapter two, this notion of antitrust law. And this is an idea from economics, the Chicago School of Economics, which is quite free market. But they basically said, look, monopoly isn't a problem if the price is low. So the idea is that in a monopoly, they're going to raise prices above the competitive level, you'll rip off consumers, and therefore, if you have a situation where there's quite a large firm, but they're not increasing prices, then there's not really a problem, right? Like a high price is a symptom of monopoly, and equally low prices must mean that there's some kind of competition, even if they're a large firm. Maybe they're worried about new entrants or whatever. But what this missed, I think, was all of the power that accrues to large firms and their owners outside of just being able to increase the price. And a lot of the basic Econ 101 models focus on just price, really. But there are a whole load of things that they can do. They can exploit and squeeze small suppliers. They can price competitors out of the market. They can exploit and squeeze their workers, the environment, and, of course, the wealth and power that the owners have can also then accrue influence and political power. And that's something that was understood by the older idea of antitrust, like in the era of Theodore Roosevelt and trust busting. It was said, the Sherman Act, the creator of the Sherman Act, I forget his first name, but he said, if we would not tolerate a dictator in the sphere of politics, why in economics? Why would we allow one man to run all of our rail infrastructure, all of our oil fields, right? In these days, it would be like all of our kind of internet infrastructure. Why would we allow that? We don't allow dictators in the political sphere, so not we shouldn't in the economic sphere. But that's a much more general point than just is the price high or low. And that's something that's been really missed. And I do think that you could place the blame for this situation to some extent on that school of antitrust and on the economists who promoted it, because they don't think about politics that much historically. And as a result, they've just missed all of these brewing problems, all of the massive power that a lot of these companies have accrued. Because if you look at Amazon, like prices in Amazon are obviously quite low. Like they're low enough to usually not attract the attention of the competition authorities. But Jeff Bezos has built an empire. He owns so many different things that aren't necessarily even directly related to Amazon. I mean, he bought the Washington Post, for example, and that in itself should be unacceptable.
Yeah, the idea that it's okay to have one person controlling Amazon, even like this huge distribution company, or one person controlling Google, or a small group of people, the board or whatever, as long as they keep prices low, is like missing the point fundamentally. This complete disregard for power and for what it means in the world. And if they have the power, to keep the prices low, then you're giving them the power to increase them. The problem with having a king or queen ruling over people, a dictator, isn't just that it's fine as long as they're